Blog Talk Radio.
Radio Free Palmer, 89.5 KVRF, presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to Day 7 coverage of the 2013 Iditarod. I am hosting from the mushing capital of the world, Willow, Alaska. And on the line, we have writer and director of the movie Mush, the movie, a documentary about the Iditarod, and the co-host for our annual Iditarod coverage here on Mushing Radio. His name is Alex Stein. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great, Robert. I'm very excited. We've reached a point in the race where things are really starting to happen in a big way. And I've got to tell you, the Iditarod is always exciting, but this year it seems like it's shaping up to be a particularly great race.
You know, it is. I was looking at the standings on Iditarod.com right before we went on air, and what I find exciting is we don't have a lot of scratched mushers yet, and that's always good. I don't know if that's just because of the folks that are on the trail, the conditions of the trail, the speed of the trail, but I'm happy to report that very few mushers have had to scratch this year, and of course, none have had to withdraw.
Yeah, and that's always good, and I think we were probably both a little bit worried about that because we had heard before the race started that the trail was not in good condition, and, you know, it's a hard enough race when the trail is in good condition, but when the trail is not up to par, it can become especially hard on mushers, especially the rookies and the ones who aren't as seasoned and aren't as experienced in it. So I'm very, very happy that we have had a relatively light number of mushers scratching.
Also, yeah, only three, with the exception of Ed Strelstra, who scratched at the airstrip. Interesting story in of itself, but three mushers 6 days into the Iditarod scratching, that's a pretty good number.
Yeah, it's a great number. And I was looking at the standings, and we've got, in the top 15, We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 former champions in the top 15. Martin Boozer leading, and then we've got Mitch Seavey, and then Jeff King, Dallas Seavey, and Lance Mackey all together at 13, 14, and 15. And it's a very exciting race when you have some of the top mushers. And in addition to those guys, we have perennial top 10 finishers like Didi Genro and Paul Gebhardt and Ali Zirkel and Aaron Burmeister, who are all right up there at the top of the Iditarod food chain right now.
You know, what I also find interesting, and usually he or she is right in this general position, but Yor Olsson, we talked about him just the other day. He is the top rookie this year in terms of standings, probably going to snag that Rookie of the Year honor, which is given out to the first rookie over the finish line. He's doing very well in 12th place, and he is out of Anvik, I believe, at this point, heading on his way to Grayling.
Yes, exactly. There's an interesting thing when you're looking at the standings. We talked a lot about the 24-hour layover and how that figured into it. Martin, of course, took his 24 very, very early, and then when the others who were sort of in the major first pack took their 24s, he was able to leapfrog ahead of them. On the Yukon River, there also is a mandatory 8-hour layover that you can take at any of the checkpoints on the Yukon River and also at Shagaluk. Shagaluk is not technically on the Yukon. It's right before you get to the Yukon, but you can take your 8-hour Yukon River layover there as well. So Martin took his at Anvik, and Ali Zirkel and Aaron, I believe, are taking theirs now. But because they had to stop for that 8 hours, Ali had gone ahead of had gone ahead of Boozer, and then she stopped, and now Martin has gone ahead of her. And it looks like when all of this is said and done and everyone has taken their eight-hour layovers, Martin is going to be between 4 and 6 hours ahead of the next teams that are coming up behind him.
That's exactly right. And I definitely want to get into that meal here in just a second that Martin won, provided by the Millennium Hotel. But before I do, interesting commentary from Dallas Seavey's wife, Jen, on Facebook. And she was talking about just the incredible run that Martin is doing. And she compared it to other mid-distance races and how long they are and what dogs have left in the tank. And she talked about being well over 400 miles from Roan to Eagle Island. And I assume that's where he's heading to here pretty soon. I don't know what he's doing. He's pretty much got the pedal to the metal still. He is rocking and rolling and doing very well. I know it's a little too close to call, but it sure does look like his race to lose. What do you think?
You know, I hate to make predictions because I am almost always very, very wrong. But it certainly does look like he's going to be right up there, you know, going up the coast and towards the end. Having said that, I think, you know, you don't want to count out someone like Allie Zirkle. Allie, I think, really, really is in this race to win it in a way that she hasn't been before, even last year when she finished second.
Exactly. And you said that he will have about a six-hour lead on Allie and Aaron Burmeister. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
That's tough to make up. Just from a musher's perspective, that's about a 40-mile leap. So either he really has to flame out pretty hard, or do something probably off his schedule. 6 hours is tough to make up. I know folks can do it. I'm thinking of Ramey Smith right now and how he pretty much just leapfrogs everybody from about mid race forward. But man, 6 hours is a tough spot to jump over, I think.
Yeah, but you know, having said that, a bunch of the people chasing him, and I'm thinking about Mitch Seavey in particular, Aaron Burmeister and Jake Berkowitz, their dog teams are doing spectacularly well. Aaron Burmeister still has 15 dogs. Jake Berkowitz has all of his dogs. He's resting now in Grayling. So those two, if they're able to turn up the gas just a little bit, might be able to make a move.
I sure hope so. It's going to turn out to be an amazing race any way you look at it. But let's talk a little bit about that meal that he got. The musher that is first to the Yukon gets a pretty big spread. I believe it's a 5-course meal provided by the Millennium Hotel. Everything from a big old 22-ounce steak, I believe it is, seafood, dessert, wine, the whole nine yards. I know that you posted a picture on our DogWorks radio page today, or it might have been on yours, about him sitting there at the table, I assume, shortly after he got there. What do you think about that? Just from a musher's perspective, I'm not very hungry out there on the trail. I'm definitely not interested in a 5-course meal.
Yeah, you know, it's always an interesting thing to me because I'm told, and this hasn't been the case since I've been closely following the Iditarod, but I'm told that there have been times where the musher will get to that first Yukon River checkpoint and have someone close on their tail and not really want to hang around to have the 5-course meal, and you know, and then you know, I always feel tired when I eat a lot, so I would imagine that someone would feel a little bit tired, although having come off of however many hours without sleep and sheer exhaustion, maybe that's just filling their tank back up. It's interesting, though, because this prize last year, very, very late, right after the media guides had been printed up, within a week or so of the race, the Millennium pulled out of offering this prize, which is something that a lot of people look forward to and is something that the fans always talk a lot about. And listeners from last year might remember that Scott Jansen, the Mushing mortician who unfortunately had to scratch this year, Scott actually stepped up last year and donated, I believe, $2,500 of his own money so that the first the first team to the Yukon would at least have a prize, even though they didn't get the meal. And I'm very happy to report that the Millennium is back this year sponsoring this. They fly their executive chef up in a small plane. I have the menu in front of me. It's appetizer of portobello mushroom stuffed with red king crab, Alaskan clam chowder, roast duck salad, a ribeye steak, a fruit tart, and then a bottle of Dom Perignon.
Wow. You know, one thing that I found interesting, a good friend of mine and perennial Iditarod guy who happens to be running over in Norway this week, Hugh Neff, he's running in the Finnmark Sloped race, kind of Europe's own Iditarod. He won this, I believe it was in 2011, he won this meal to the first musher to the Yukon. And he told me, Alex, that whether you eat it or not, you kind of have a meal ticket given to you that you can redeem at any point at the Millennium Hotel downtown and have that same meal all over again well after you're rested. It could be months or even weeks later when you can go down there and have that same meal at the Millennium.
Yes, that's exactly right. And I imagine it's probably something you'll enjoy a lot more when you're in Anchorage as opposed to being out on the trail.
Don't they also receive some type of cash reward for being the first of the Yukon? I'm thinking it's that $2,500 to $3,000 thing that you mentioned from Scott Jansen last year. Is that true?
Yeah, actually, this year it's $3,500, which they refer to as an after-dinner mint, and they give them $3,500 $1 bills.
Wow. That is awesome. And I know Scott Jansen did that last year, and everybody knows about Scott Jansen being the Mushin' Mortician. He gave it out last year. Who was it for? Mitch Seavey, and he gave it to him in a little coffin, all in $100 bills?
Exactly.
Very cool. You could still have a sense of humor even after a week of no sleep and pretty much just mushing your butt off up to Nome. You can still have a sense of humor.
Exactly. Go ahead. I was just going to say another thing that we wanted to mention. We had talked a little bit yesterday about Newton Marshall having to scratch because there was the dog May was missing from his team, and I'm happy to report that May has been spotted this afternoon. I do not believe that she's been caught yet, but she has been spotted, so they know that she's out there, and I'm confident that she'll be captured and captured is not the right word. She'll be caught and brought to safety and fed and well taken care of very shortly.
You know, and speaking of that, that's pretty much a sled dog's nature, Alex, to be a little spooked like that. And for folks that heard that 90-second thing, I don't know why our platform is kicking off our live coverage, but we will continue to stream over after we air, and you can catch this on our podcast. I don't know why that's happening. It's usually a busy time for our platform. So don't worry, folks, you can hear all of our show on our podcast. But back to the sled dog thing, Alex, it is very typical for sled dogs to be a little shy like that. You know, they're not around a lot of people that they don't know, whether it's their handlers or their mushers or the family. So it's very typical for them to be a little shy and difficult to catch like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, and I would imagine, and tell me if this is right or not, but as the dog gets a little bit more hungry, then probably she will be much more receptive and it will be easier to catch her.
Yes, and typically if dogs are around, and there's still going to be plenty of dog teams coming into that checkpoint there, was it at McGrath or Nikolai?
I believe it was Nikolai.
Yeah, there's going to be plenty of dog teams still coming into there, so typically they are pack animals, so they'll follow where the dogs are and, of course, where the food is. So there's a pretty dang good chance that they'll catch her relatively quickly. I've had a lot of sled dogs in my day get off the chain or whatnot, and pretty much always we always catch them, even if it's 2 or 3 days later.
Yeah, absolutely. So we're looking forward to her being reunited with the rest of her team.
Yes, exactly. And one thing we do want to mention, we talked about last night about Newton using other people's dogs, and we talked about Kelly Griffin's team he was using. This was actually one of Jim Lanier's younger dogs. They called it a puppy in the press release. So he had dogs from other folks.
Okay.
So Alex, tonight's topic, a very interesting topic that we talked about off air, about the economics or the cost of running the Iditarod. You know, that's a subject that comes up all the time. I deal with it myself just in terms of my own pocketbook, so I know exactly what it's going to take to run a race like this. So tonight we're going to talk about how expensive this race is. What do you have on tap for us on that subject?
Well, you know, I think a lot of people, when they look at what it would cost to run the Iditarod, they don't take into account everything that's involved. And that ranges from entry fees for the race itself to paying for the food drops, to ship sleds ahead if you're going to have an extra sled that you're going to position somewhere on the trail, to either raising your own dogs, and then there's food associated with it, there's vet bills, or leasing a team. And if you lease a team from an established Iditarod team, that in itself can cost anywhere from $15,000 to $50,000 just to do that. So there are a lot of little things that go into it that I don't think everyone always thinks about when they think about, maybe I could just get a few dogs and run the Iditarod.
Yeah, exactly right. In my case, as well as a lot of other mushers, we moved up here from Colorado to Alaska to train for and eventually run the Iditarod. So not only does it cost everything that it's going to cost to get to the starting line, and of course everything that's going to be to run the race, we also purchased a home up here. We moved my entire family up here. We closed down a very successful business, a dog training business in Colorado, to come up here and do this. We purchased a home for $150,000 just to move up here for Iditarod. There was a book written by Craig Medred, a reporter for the Alaska Dispatch, that's called Graveyard of Dreams. Have you had a chance to read that, Alex?
I have. It's a fantastic book, and I would heartily recommend it to anyone who's interested in the Iditarod.
And I know he goes into pretty in-depth discussion about that in his book, as well as all of the other dreams that are kind of scattered from Anchorage to Nome, whether it be marriages or lost opportunities in terms of jobs and all that sort of stuff. An excellent read. I had him on my show a couple of years ago when the book was first released, and that is definitely something that any Iditarod fan should read. But getting back to the subject, as of right now, a good conservative estimate, and Alex had mentioned anywhere from $15,000 for a leased team all the way up to hundreds of thousands in terms of if you're moving your house and things, it's about $35,000 to $50,000 to run the Iditarod. That is an extreme amount of money for a 2-week dog adventure, don't you think?
Absolutely. And as longtime fans may know, the first time that you finish the Iditarod, you are given a belt buckle. You don't get a belt buckle every time you finish, but the first time you finish, you get a belt buckle. And I've heard a number of mushers refer to this belt buckle as the world's most expensive piece of jewelry.
Yes.
Because you literally can spend... You will spend tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars to get that belt buckle.
And you know what's so concerning, I don't know if that's the appropriate word, about all of those people that put in all of this money and it all goes down to the drain in just a few days if they scratch. You know, I'm mm-hmm. thinking of some of the folks that have scratched in recent history and how they, you know, they've put everything in with their heart and soul and moving and everything else, and it quickly dwindles very, very quickly when they are forced to scratch. Do you have anything on that?
Yeah, it really can, and I think for some people, especially people who are not as experienced, there is some pressure, at least in their mind, to try to stay in the race more than might make sense if they're just looking at it in a strictly objective way, because they feel that they have invested all of this time and energy and money. I think with racers who are a little bit more experienced, they realize that that is not the primary concern. The primary concern is the health and well-being of the dogs and, you know, frankly, secondarily, the health and well-being of the musher. But there is a lot of pressure on people, especially people who have come from somewhere else or maybe feel like this is their one chance to do it, that they should stay in.
Exactly. And for folks, another little bit of perspective here. Here at our kennel, we have 33 dogs right now. 22 of them are of racing age or racing caliber. Then several younger dogs or older dogs. We spend about $1,200 just on dog food a month, and that is only dog food, nothing else, no other medical care, no other equipment expenses, nothing like that. So not only is the cost of getting to the Iditarod very expensive, but just the monthly food bill for an Iditarod caliber kennel or a kennel that is training for the Iditarod. And we have a very small kennel by Iditarod standards. Some of the big names, they have upwards to 100 dogs, so triple that of what we spend on our food a year. And we aren't racing every week like some of these guys are.
Right. It's, you know, there are some mushers who are who work full-time jobs and train their dogs and then run the Iditarod, which obviously is very, very difficult because they're working 40 or 45 hours a week and then training their dogs on, you know, taking the dogs out for runs in the night or early in the morning and on weekends. And that can be exhausting. It's exhausting enough for a lot of people just to work full-time, you know, 9-to-5 jobs. There are other people who deliberately will take jobs that pay very well, like jobs on the North Slope, for example, and work for several months at a time and then be able to take a few months off during the winter in order to train their dogs or in order to run the Iditarod.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, and then there's a small number of racers who are able to essentially be full-time dog mushers and perhaps augment that with some seasonal work or with, you know, giving dog rides during the off season. But mostly this is not something that people go into to make a lot of money, because the amount that you have to spend is so far in excess of anything you're going to get back.
And for just one other perspective, then I have a question for you, Alex, is the winner this year will get a little bit shy of $51,000. I believe it's $50,600, if I'm not mistaken. That money there will pretty much just cover the operating expenses for the following year in terms of dog food and care of those dogs. Other than that, there's not a lot of money in the pocket after the winnings are doled out. And of course you got to pay the uncle too.
Yeah, exactly. And the winner also gets a new truck, which is worth about $40,000. Lance Mackey said that he's won four times. He said the first truck that he won went to his ex-wife. He still has the second truck that he won. The third truck he sold to pay expenses, and I believe the fourth truck he said he sold and bought a sports car instead. But, you know, as we talked about the other day, the truck that he has that he won, I believe, in 2009, has almost 300,000 miles on it. So
exactly.
He said he could use a new truck.
You know, Alex, just I want to get your perspective a little bit as a fan. You've been a part of this for a long time, and I'm sure you've talked to a lot of folks. We mentioned that very expensive piece of jewelry. My question to you, obviously, I'm trying to get there myself, is why in the world do people do it then? If it's a losing proposition in terms of financial, why in the world do people come back year after year after year? Not necessarily the big names, but the middle of the pack guys, the guys that are at the back of the pack that obviously are not getting any winnings at all. Why do you think they come back year after year?
You know, there's a there's an expression that people catch the mushing bug and they just fall in love with the sport and they just can't imagine being away from it, even if they're not competing in it. They can't imagine being away from the lifestyle. And I think that that is a large part of it, that there's something about this sport, and there's something in particular about the Iditarod that is just so compelling that it's hard to get around that. There's a great book by Gary Paulson called Winter Dance, and the subtitle is The Fine Madness of Running the Iditarod. And when you look at it objectively, it's an insane thing to do from a lot of different perspectives, including financial. And yet there's something about it that just draws people back over and over again.
You know, some of the most popular mushers are those mushers that are the middle of the pack or back of the pack guys. I'm thinking one in particular, Karen Ramstead. She is a very, mm-hmm. very popular musher. She has said many times she knows she'll never win, especially with her Siberian Huskies, but she comes back year after year. In the last few years, she's taken a year off here or there, but she's one of those gals that that comes back no matter what and puts her whole heart and soul into it every year.
Yeah, and, you know, it's interesting because she's not racing this year, but she's one of the judges. She's one of the race judges. So she is out there on the trail, and people who follow her either on Twitter or Facebook, she is posting things once or twice a day. So you can still keep up with her even though she's not running the race. So even with her, she's not there competing this year, but she couldn't stay away.
Exactly, and of course, most of the folks that are working for Iditarod and Iditarod.com right now, I'm thinking of Joe Runyon is one. On Alaska Dispatch side, Zach Steer is another. All of these guys have run the race many times through the years. And like Alex said, it's one of those things, the mushing bug. Who I'm thinking of right now is Sebastian Chenal. He can't get away from it either. He said he's going to retire and live on a yacht, but he seems to come back every year. I think once we catch that bug, we're stuck.
Yeah, and speaking of Sebastian, people should follow him on Facebook. And also on Iditarod.com, he's following the race on a snow machine, and he has been posting some amazing, amazing pictures and commentary about the race, which is just – and he has such a great perspective as someone who up until very recently was running the race and was a favorite among people who follow the race.
Exactly. So, Alex, we're 6:28 right now. We are recording, so I don't imagine we can not continue. We can go for another few minutes, of course, since we're not going to get booted off, at least from this perspective. Let's talk about our featured musher of the evening. Like I told folks yesterday, we pick these guys sometime early in the day before we go on air. And today, fan favorite, as always, probably one of the most heralded names in mushing, the CV family. We're not talking about last year's champion, at least not yet, but we're talking about his dad. Who is it?
Oh, actually, I was going to talk about Alan Moore today.
Hey, Alex, hold on. You know, I apologize that maybe we have to talk about Mitch tomorrow, but we are talking about Alan Moore. I don't know how I got
to. We'll talk about Mitch tomorrow.
Yeah, we'll talk about Mitch tomorrow. So folks that are listening, see, they aren't even listening right now. So I guess it really doesn't matter who we're talking about tomorrow because they won't hear it anyway yet. So we're talking about Alan Moore. great choice, a guy who doesn't get a lot of press. Yeah, did all that build-up, and now we got to go back to Allen.
Yeah. Well, that's the way it happens sometimes. So
it
Alan
is.
Moore is some Iditarod fans might know him better as being Ali Zirkle's husband. He's 55. He grew up in Arkansas and went to Arkansas State, where he played college basketball. He came up to Alaska a little over 20 years ago because he said he was tired of the heat and the humidity, wanted a change. He had two girls who were very interested in dogs, so they started getting some Alaskan Huskies and then started doing some small sprint races. The girls eventually moved on and were not interested in racing anymore, but Alan kept on with it. And he, over the past few years, has become one of the premier mid-distance racers. He and Ali Zirkle operate the ST Kennels, and generally what they've done is he will run the younger dogs and really train and work with the younger dogs. They've both run the Iditarod a few times. He didn't run it last year. And he, in addition to, you know, competing in races like the Sheep Mountain 150, the Kinnick 200, and the Copper Basin 300, which he's won three times, he started running the Yukon Quest, which is what people might know as the other 1,000-mile dog race that takes place in February. He ran that for the first time in 2011, and he finished sixth, which was a very good finish. There were a lot of scratches that year. And then last year, he finished the race, and then towards the very end of the race, and Alan tried to come back but couldn't quite make it. So Huneff won over Alan Moore last year in the Yukon Quest by only 26 seconds. Alan Moore was awarded the Sportsmanship Award during that race because he was very helpful to several other fellow mushers who needed assistance for various things. This past year, this past February, he ran the Yukon Quest again. And he was, at the last checkpoint, he was 15 minutes ahead of Hugh Neff, and he was able to build on that lead and win the race this year. Traditionally, what they've done in the years when he's run the Quest is he will run the A team that Ali then takes on the Iditarod Trail. So Hugh Neff gave Ali, or trained and then turned over to Ali, the dogs that she is using to run the Iditarod. And it's very interesting because the two of them last year came very, very close to winning the Iditarod and the Yukon Quest, but each of them came in second. And I think that was a bit of a wake-up call for them and for their kennel, because when you're a top 10 or a top 5 finisher, your goal is to improve, but when you come that close to winning, it becomes something that you're really thinking about and that you realize is a distinct possibility. And each of them seems to have changed their focus and changed their personal training and how they work with the dogs just a little bit and tweaked it so that they're now looking at this as not just events that they're going to run and do well at, but events that they can actually win. Alan Moore is a really wonderful guy with a great Southern accent. The first time I interviewed him in 2010, there was a European guy who interviewed him just before I did, and he asked the stupidest question I've ever heard asked of anyone associated with the Iditarod, which was, what do you hope to do differently this year than last year if you ran last year, which I'm not sure of, and how do you hope to change things if you're going to change anything, or what have you done the same that you're going to do again? And Alan Moore, to his credit, was very, very patient with this guy who clearly had no idea who he was or what he had done, and gave him a very, very intelligent answer. Both Alan and Allie are very well known for spending a lot of time with their fans, for being really interested in getting people to understand the ins and outs of the sport. On their website, they post a lot of videos of things in the race, behind-the-scenes things. Allie frequently in Iditarod will have a little GoPro camera on her sled and will post these great videos of what it's like coming into Nome or coming through safety. And they're really just both terrific ambassadors for the sport. Alan is currently, last I checked, I believe he was in 29th place. He's running younger dogs in the Iditarod, so he's looking for and expecting a middle-of-the-pack finish and really just getting the dogs used to the idea of traveling long distances and going to Nome, so that in a couple of years, some of the dogs that he's running this year will be on the A-team and will be dogs that Allie will take to Nome.
Awesome commentary there, Alex. You know, one great thing about that is not only the great drive and the competitive nature that they have in each other, but they complement each other very well. They call themselves the red team and the black team, and Allie is typically running that red team, which is, of course, as you mentioned, the A team, whereas Alan runs that black team. But also, as far as I know, they are the only married couple out there on the trail this year. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct this year. In the past, there have been a couple. You know, it's hard to, we talked about the economics. It's hard to run one team. It is obviously harder to run two teams. And so some of the larger kennels, 1 year, Dallas and Jen Seavey both ran the Iditarod, I think in either 09 or 2010. And since then, Jen has not been running, and they've been concentrating on Dallas running. So it's a difficult thing. It's not unheard of for there to be other married couples. Both Allie and Alan have said that it's really wonderful to, because mushing, especially if you're doing it at that level, is such an all-consuming sport. It's great to be able to have your spouse and your partner be someone that you can really be involved with in every aspect of this. And so they feed the dogs together, they run the dogs together, they train the dogs together, and then they divide up the dogs and they take them on different races, and the idea being to put together the best team possible and then have Allie take that team to Nome in the Iditarod.
Great story. I'm looking forward to Allie winning this race. She's been my pick for the last couple of years. I would love to have a woman win the Iditarod. It has been a while since that has happened, so I'm looking forward for that to happen. Hopefully this year. Of course, we're definitely not counting out Martin or any of the other contenders there, but it sure would be great for that family who is so active and passionate about the sport to finish first in the Nome. What do you think?
Yeah, and Allie is one of these people who she just lights up. She is always smiling. She is, I'm sure she's not always 100% happy, but almost every time I've seen her, she looks very happy. She's clearly someone who's doing something that she completely loves. And that comes through anytime you see her interviewed. There was a photo that I saw that I think we posted where she came into where? She came into one of the checkpoints, and this is not an official Iditarod prize, but one of the local residents had made a pair of handmade gloves that they gave to the first the first team that came in, and Allie was the one who won that. And there's a picture, we posted of her there. It wasn't, it popped out of my head right now, which checkpoint it was.
I can't recall either. I'm thinking that it was at ANVIC, if I remember correctly. It was just today that occurred, and very nice like moose-hide mittens.
Might have been Grayling.
Could have been Grayling,
I'm thinking maybe it was Grayling, yeah.
Well, we need to head
over
to our DogWorks radio page and they can find out for sure, because we did post that picture a few hours ago. But definitely a cool pair of mittens. And like you said, she's just beaming all of that energy right there in that photo. And every time I've ever spoken to her or have met her a couple of times, she's that same way. She's always happy-go-lucky and always has time for her fans, and I'm sure her husband does as well, too. So best of luck to Alan Moore and his wife, Allie. We definitely are rooting for you here at Mushing Radio. We had spoken to Allie on our Mushing Radio show this year, and she was one of our best interviews of the year. So if you haven't had a chance to listen to that, all of our archive shows there are on mushingradio.com. Great interview with Allie, and she talks a little bit about her husband and their relationship on that as well. Definitely a dedicated and competitive family.
Yeah, and, you know, there's a lot of one of the things that is very satisfying for me, being a fan of the sport, is that most of the people that we think of as the top competitors are also fantastic ambassadors for the sport. You know, Dallas Seavey is a young guy who is very enthusiastic and just wants to talk about mushing. Lance Mackey is a very funny and insightful guy who has a lot to say and really wants people to know about what it's like out on the trail. Martin Boozer is a guy who literally opens his kennel to fans to come out before the race and meet with him and meet with his dogs. Didi Genro is someone who is always has time for fans, and, you know, it just goes on and on.
It does, and I'm thinking of all of those same names as well, and just how much that I've learned over the years about mushing, just hearing them talk, whether it be at a seminar or through books or whatever. These guys are great ambassadors, and many of them will take that time to teach a fellow musher a thing or two. Not everything is held close to the vest, as a lot of people think.
Yeah, and you know that really goes back to the earliest days of the Iditarod, the modern Iditarod, when this was something that the mushers were anyone who wanted to come up and was willing to spend the time to learn about it, they wanted to teach them and they wanted to share whatever they could, and that is a spirit that is still alive and well in the Iditarod today.
So, Alex, we are out of time, but we definitely want to close the show as we always do. What do you think is going to happen in the next 24 hours?
Well, you know, it looks like Martin is going to continue to move up the trail. A lot of the other mushers in the top 10 and 15 are taking their 8-hour mandatory Yukon River rest. So I think this time tomorrow we're going to have a much clearer view of what the top 10 is going to look like going into the coast. So I think we're really going to see a clarification of things.
Do you have anything in the middle of the pack, any interesting stories there that you want to talk about tomorrow that people can maybe do a little research on? Anything brewing there in, 30 on down?
You know, there's a musher named Mike Ellis who is running a team of Siberians. I believe he's the only team of Siberians this year. There's some interesting stuff there. Cindy Abbott, who we talked about a few days ago, is currently the Red Lantern, but she seems to be doing very well after her 24. There's a group of people who had traveled together towards the end of the pack last year who are still not exactly at the end of the pack, but around there, and I'm talking about Jan Steves and Bob Schlupak. And, you know, there's Mike Williams and Mike Williams Jr., who have been traveling together a little bit. So, and of course, we haven't talked at all about the Barrington twins who are traveling together, Christy and Anna Barrington.
You know, and that seems to be something that they do often, that they'll travel down the trail together. I know they did it a lot last year. They're currently in 41st and 42nd place, right there in the middle of the pack in Iditarod. Very interesting story. I know you and I talked about them as one of our featured mushers last year. And, of course, folks can listen to that as well. If you want to listen to some of our 2012 stories, you can do that as well on Mushing Radio. But, yeah, there's always a lot of stuff there. And I'm just looking down these names. It's sad that we only have a couple of weeks of this coverage, because we could talk about these mushers for the next 66 days, I think, don't you think?
Absolutely. And, you know, and that's one of the reasons why we try to concentrate on not just the mushers that people have heard of and that get a lot of press and a lot of coverage, but on some of the middle of the pack and the back of the pack mushers as well, because their stories are sometimes a lot more compelling and at least as compelling as some of the ones who are right up at the front.
So, Alex, anything else in closing?
You know, it continues to be very warm. On the Yukon River, there was light rain for a lot of the day today. Lance Mackey is trying to rest during the day and do a lot of running at night when things are freezing over. I'm told that the trail from on the Yukon River and up the coast is going to be relatively good and very fast. So I think we're going to continue to have a really, really great and fast front of the pack.
Totally agree. Looking forward to it tomorrow, Alex. And again, for folks that want to listen to us after we are done recording on any day, they can pick up that recorded show on Mushing Radio, mushingradio.com. Make sure you follow us on Facebook, Dogworks Radio. We post a lot of pictures and stories. Typically, right after we're off air, we are in Iditarod mode, and we post a lot of stuff back and forth there and on our Twitter feeds as well. Alex is at Coldfoot Films, and I am at Dogworks Radio. Alex, I'll talk to you tomorrow, okay?
All right. Thanks, Robert.
Thanks, and that was my co-host for Iditarod coverage, Alex Stein, and this is Robert Forto. We'll see you guys next time. Goodbye.